20-6154, United States versus Alexander. And I see that counsel is present. Please feel free to start whenever you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honors, and good morning. My name is Lynn Hartfield, and I represent the defendant, Santia Alexander, the appellant. This case raises the question of whether there's a limit in terms of quantity and quality of evidence as to what constitutes sufficient evidence to, excuse me, are you having trouble hearing?
No, I'm not.
Okay. I'm sorry. I wanted to make sure.
I was trying to read my notes, and as you can see, some of them are very small.
So
I was simply trying to read them.
All right. This case raises the question of whether there's a limit in terms of quantity and quality as to what constitutes sufficient evidence to support a given guideline enhancement. Now, the guidelines, of course, do allow for a judge to increase a defendant's sentence based on factors that are proved by a preponderance of the evidence, and that standard has survived many challenges. However, the sentencing procedure still has to comply with due process, and the guidelines shouldn't be used as an end run around the due process to which all criminal defendants are entitled. But that's precisely what happened in this case. In this case, a shooting occurred, state authorities did almost no investigation, and not surprisingly, the state district attorney's office declined the prosecution. The U.S. attorney's office, even though it had basically a slam dunk 25-year mandatory minimum case against Mr. Alexander, decided to try to increase his sentence by 20 years based pretty much entirely on hearsay statements from his on-again, off-again girlfriend. Now, what's particularly troubling about this case is that there was so much easily performed investigation that wasn't done. There was no photo lineup done for either the victim or the witness who saw the shooter. There weren't any ballistic analysis performed. There was no tracing of the phone number that called Erica Talton. There was no voice comparison of Mr. Alexander to the voice on the calls. There was no examining him for gunshot residue or his clothing. Nobody bothered to get medical records on the victim. Nobody spoke to the treating physician. Nobody recontacted the victim to see if he had any ongoing injury. These are not high cost investigative steps to take. And the absence of this kind of investigation raises questions about why they weren't done, or even if they were done and they didn't perhaps point to Mr. Alexander as the shooter.
Well, weren't some of Ms. Talton's statements corroborated by other witnesses?
Her statements regarding
what happened right before the shooting?
Absolutely. The issue is not that somebody didn't shoot this guy. Somebody shot Mr. Hurst. The issue is who shot Mr. Hurst. Was it Mr. Alexander? And the only evidence we have of that is Ms. Talton's statements. And the Fennell case, this court said basically that the statements of a girlfriend or ex-girlfriend is really not enough. And there's a good reason for that.
Well, you know, we've departed. We've not just walked away from that case. It looks to me like we've run away from that case. It's been cited 32 times, and every time it's been distinguished, saying that, in fact, girlfriends can and ex-girlfriends and ex-wives can testify credibly.
They can when there's corroborating evidence. And in all of those cases cited by the government, there was corroborating evidence. It wasn't just an ex-girlfriend or girlfriend making an accusation. There were statements from other witnesses. There were statements from victims. There was physical evidence to corroborate. This case is more like Fennell, because the only difference between this and Fennell is that the police officer spoke with Ms. Talton in person. But otherwise, we just have her statement that this guy on the phone was Mr. Alexander. And if she harbored some kind of a grudge against him, this would be a very easy way to get him in trouble. Taking the arguments in sequence, as a threshold matter, the evidence was insufficient to prove that Mr. Alexander was the shooter. And I think, again, we want to be clear, there was plenty of evidence that Mr. Hurst was shot, and that person called Ms. Talton at the same time. The problem is that the only evidence that it was Mr. Alexander and not somebody else comes from this hearsay statement by Talton. And when you have a witness who has the potential for this much bias, there needs to be corroborating evidence. And as I pointed out, it would have been easy to find corroborating evidence in this case.
Bias. Was there evidence that in fact she was hostile to the defendant? I mean, wasn't he the one that initiated the phone call to her?
Again, if that person making the call was Mr. Alexander, yes. But the issue is that all we know about the relationship between Ms. Talton and Mr. Alexander is that they had supposedly an on-again, off-again relationship that was quite volatile. And that's all we know. So the issue is she's the only person who ties him to the shooting. It could have been some other person who called her if she had another relationship, who knows? But the point is that she's the only evidence that fingers Mr. Alexander as opposed to somebody else. And again, I think
what effort did the officers make to involve Mr. Hurst in this trial?
As I understand it, they interviewed him and he said that he did not want to testify. And that is probably why the state authorities decided not to prosecute.
And so, I mean, I suppose they could have subpoenaed him unless he was asserting the Fifth Amendment. Was there any suggestion of anything like that?
There was no reason given as to why they didn't call him. Some suggestion that he didn't want to testify. But you know, there was also some questions surrounding the victim's credibility because he failed to mention that he had a gun on him himself at the time that he was shot. There was a gun recovered at the scene, but that did not belong, was not traced back to Mr. Alexander. It was traced back to Hurst.
Does it matter that Officer Reed interviewed Ms. Talton in person, and so he had an opportunity to assess her credibility?
I think it makes it slightly less egregious than Fennell, but again, there could have been so much corroborating evidence in this case, and it just isn't there. But even if the court finds that there was enough evidence that Mr. Alexander was the one who shot Hurst, there was zero evidence that the gun that was the subject of the indictment was the gun that shot Hurst. And again, that evidence could have been obtained. It wasn't.
If you've said, even if there was evidence that Alexander shot Hurst, there's uncertainty about which gun he used. Why does that matter so much in this case? I mean, you shot him. Is it really critical that they prove the exact gun that was used? I assume that the indictment identified a specific gun. Is that what limits the prosecution, or why is that such a critical piece of evidence?
It's critical to the which guideline enhancement applies. So there are two different potential enhancements to apply if the court were to find that the shooting occurred, or that Mr. Alexander was the shooter. One would be a four-level enhancement, which we think would be the appropriate one if the court were to find that Mr. Hurst were the shooter. And the other requires a cross-reference to a much greater guideline.
I'm not questioning at all how important it was to show that Hurst was the shooter. My question is, why is the identity of the specific gun so critical here? Was it because you restricted yourself to that in the information or indictment, and therefore you're bound to prove that, or was there some other reason?
So it's not critical to the indictment itself. It's critical to the guideline enhancements.
But I didn't understand it. So go ahead. I don't want to use all of your time. Just give me 30 seconds move on. Okay,
I'll give you the short version. There are two different enhancements that can be applied when the court finds that the gun was used in or was involved in another offense. One is a four-level enhancement. It doesn't require that it be the same gun in the indictment. Another is a cross-reference to the crime itself, which results in a much greater enhancement, and that does require that it be the gun in the indictment. So that's why it's relevant.
And looking at, again, it's just a preponderance standard, right? And true. If we take your assumption in your hypothetical that in fact Mr. Alexander was the shooter. He's found 3 hours later hanging out at a house that isn't his, in possession of a firearm, and his story is, I think somebody gave it to him or he found it, I can't remember.
Found it on the ground.
Okay. Isn't the trial judge allowed to assess probabilities here? He asked Miss Terrell to pick him up. She didn't. He was on foot. He traveled where he could travel on foot, and he was still in possession of a gun when they picked him up. I mean, isn't it a reasonable inference based on that evidence that was the same gun he just used in the shooting?
Well, this is one instance where Mr. Alexander's record actually helps him. He's been cited for having a gun, I think, multiple times, and that's why he was subject to a 25-year mandatory minimum in this case. So for some people, it might be very significant that they were found with a gun 3 hours after there was a shooting. I think with Mr. Alexander, it doesn't really make much difference.
You're shifting back to whether he was the shooter. I'm saying, assume that it was reasonable to say he was the shooter. 3 hours later, when he's on foot, he's found hanging around in front of somebody else's house with a gun. So whether he has in his past possessed guns, to me, doesn't really change the reasonableness of that gun that he still had on him was the gun he used when he shot this person.
And I would say that it's not reasonable given his history that he always has a gun on him and he could have multiple guns, and it just doesn't.
Well, he didn't have multiple guns. If he had had multiple guns, we would have a problem knowing which one was recently shot, right? But anyway, my point is, if we're talking about whether we can presume from the fact that he had a gun that he was the shooter, your argument makes sense to me. But if the question is whether we can presume that the gun he had in his possession is the one he used to shoot, it doesn't seem that persuasive to me.
You know, you're about out of time, but you haven't addressed the two concerns that I'm primarily involved about here. One is the 2A21 enhancement for intent to commit murder. And the other was the enhancement for permanent or life-threatening injury. Seems to me those are maybe your two strongest arguments, and I'm intrigued you didn't raise them, but with 2 minutes to go, you probably will want to reserve time in rebuttal, but I'm just alerting the other person who's going to argue that that's a significant concern for me. But
yeah, and I'll just briefly address them so that I can preserve them. With respect to the intent to kill, the judge made no findings with respect to mens rea on that. And the case law does require that there be findings. In fact, the judge's findings point to a different offense, assault with a deadly weapon. As far as the serious bodily injury enhancement, I think the briefing is fairly comprehensive on that issue. However, I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Leverett.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Travis Leverett. I'm an AUSA with the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Western District of Oklahoma. I'm representing the United States in this case. As the court's aware, this case involves a challenge by the appellant to the calculation of his advisory guideline range. I'll start by addressing the first thing that my opposing counsel addressed, which is the level of corroboration that was present to support the sentencing enhancement for the defendant shooting the victim, Mr. Hurst, in this case. As the court's aware, the cornerstone of whether hearsay evidence can be considered at sentencing is whether the hearsay statements themselves are sufficiently corroborated. That was the fatal flaw in the Fennell case with the hearsay statements, is that the court noted in that case, there was no corroboration of those statements. Here, Ms. Talton's statements are we see layer upon layer of corroboration. As these events are playing out in real time while she's sitting at the police station, police officers observed voicemails on her phone with the man she identified as Ty and that another individual identified as Ty earlier in the evening. And that was how she initially identified the defendant before later identifying him as Santaya Alexander. He left voicemails on her phone saying that he had just been in a shootout. She identified him live as the events were unfolding. It wasn't some pre-planned thing that she came in later and gave statements about. And the most important and to me the most convincing corroboration are the circumstances of the defendant's arrest. He was arrested within 4 hours and six blocks of where this shooting occurred, in possession of a half-loaded gun at a house he had no business in, and a phony at best story of how he came to possess the gun. This idea that maybe she set this whole thing up to frame Mr. Alexander is somewhat incredible when also viewed with how they found Mr. Alexander, almost caught red-handed. Further, the identification by another male who was with Ms. Talton at the time she placed the call also corroborates her identification of Mr. Alexander as the person she was on the phone with, as well as the statements of the victim given at the hospital, that the man who shot him was talking on the phone, arguing with someone, and he said the exact same thing that Ms. Talton said, which was that the victim pleaded with Mr. Alexander that he had kids before she heard a gunshot. All those things taken together, it's pretty clear to me that there was more than enough corroboration to get this case well beyond Fennell and really even beyond most of the other cases cited by the government in its brief where corroboration of hearsay statements was at issue.
I'm going to shift you to life-threatening bodily injury. You know, the what evidence is there? I mean, we've got, he was shot, I guess, in the buttocks. And you do have some hysteria in terms of reporting after he's shot. But is that it? And do we have any case law where that's enough?
Well, Your Honor, I think you've correctly identified the most challenging part of the government's argument in this case. And I'll just begin by pointing out that it's a very deferential standard under the case law. The Williams case out of the Sixth Circuit states that this is a highly fact-specific issue and the trial court is by far best suited to conduct the analysis. It's under the clear error standard. It is not sufficient that the district court that we would reach a different conclusion when viewing the same evidence, or that the district court is even probably wrong. Instead, the standard is that it be pellucid to any objective observer under the Cadena-Sotori case. In this case, the evidence that the district court heard to support the life-threatening enhancement, the district court heard that the victim was taken to the emergency room in critical condition. The nature of
we don't know that he was in critical condition. We know that the ambulance categorized it as a call for transportation to a hospital of somebody in critical condition. But there's no evidence that anybody looked at the witness and made a medical determination of that. There's just nothing other than that was a label that the ambulance service used, which far as we know, is something they would always have to use to justify the use of an ambulance at all. I mean, there is no evidence, nobody that ever looked at the victim and made any medical diagnosis of him. So nobody could have said he was in critical condition because nobody looked at the witness, the victim.
Well, you're correct, Your Honor, that there was no medical evidence presented to support that enhancement other than the nature of the injury itself, which was that it was a gunshot. So
that goes back to Judge McHugh's question. I think the only way we could affirm this would be a conclusion that it would just be per se a life-threatening injury if you're shot in the buttocks.
I don't think so, Your Honor. And the reason I think it's a little bit more fact-specific than that and that more of a sweeping ruling isn't necessary in this case is the 911 call. where you have the victim himself clearly screaming in pain.
Of course you'd be in pain, but that's not the test. The test isn't whether he suffered a painful injury. It's whether he suffered a life-threatening injury. I don't think the evidence says that he said it was life-threatening, but even if it did, he's in no position to make a judgment of whether it's life-threatening. He's not a doctor. He's got all these clouded emotions. I don't think that evidence would require much weight at all.
Well, you're under the Whitethorn case. The determination of whether an injury is life-threatening is supposed to be made at the time the injury occurred. And at the time the injury occurred, the victim was the only person there other than the defendant. A bystander came along soon after. She can also be heard on the 911 call, continually shouting.
Do we even know who that was? And did that bystander say the man's dying, has a life-threatening injury, or just that he was shot?
She said he was shot, and she can be heard repeatedly screaming, "Oh God, oh God," into the phone. She didn't say anything about whether it was a life-threatening injury. Okay. But I would just reiterate that this is a deferential standard, and that while we might disagree with the district court's findings, it's not so far afield that it violates the clear error standard in this case.
You know, these two enhancements increase the sentence from 151 minimum to 235 minimum, from 188 max to 293 max. This isn't quite a tail wagging the dog, but the tail is at least as long as the dog in this case.
That's correct, Your Honor. I also think it's relevant on the life-threatening question. If you look at the Hinton case out of the Ninth Circuit, where the defendant in that case prevented the victim from obtaining medical care. While that's not present in this case, I do think it's relevant that the defendant abandoned the victim in the middle of the street.
I don't know how that goes to life-threatening, but then let's move to the other concern I have, which is the 2A21 enhancement for intent to commit murder. I see no evidence of an intent to commit murder unless you would have us say that a single shot to a buttocks shows sufficiently that evidence all by itself that there's an intent to commit murder. I mean, the evidence showed that he had multiple bullets in his gun. If he really wanted to shoot the guy and kill him, why didn't he use more bullets? Why didn't he shoot him in the chest? He was very close range when the shot occurred, so there's no evidence that it was an errant shot. I don't see evidence of either one of those enhancements, frankly.
And there's also not a finding here on intent, right? No finding as to mens rea.
That's correct, Your Honor. The district court judge in this case, it was not objected to that the pre-sentence report suggested the enhancement for attempted murder rather than assault with a deadly. Rather, the defendant chose to argue, "I didn't commit this shooting at all," not "I committed it, but I didn't have the appropriate mens rea." That, I think that's why the district court did not make that finding as to mens rea.
So we're looking at under plain error?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Did he object to either of those enhancements?
He objected to the enhancement for assault with a deadly, which was applied in a guideline range that was ultimately not used, because it didn't exceed the guideline range for attempted murder, the cross-reference.
But he did not object to the enhancement for assault with intent to commit murder, and he did not object to the finding that this was life-threatening.
He did object to the finding that it was life-threatening, Your Honor. That was viewed under the clear error standard, not plain error.
Okay.
And to your earlier question, Judge Ebell, which I don't think I got a chance to answer about the intent and whether there needs to be a sweeping ruling as to any gunshot wound to the buttocks is automatically an attempted murder. That's essentially what the Sixth Circuit has held in a couple of cases before then. They've held that you don't even have to hit the victim. Simply shooting a gun at the body of another person is sufficient to get you to the intent and to fulfill the intent requirement.
I'd rather circumcise the sixth commandment. That strikes me as a dubious proposition. So first, is there any 10th circuit law on that? And secondly, have you done a circuit-wide search of other circuits, not just the sixth, but I'd be curious how the balance of authority weighs out on that one in other circuits.
Well, I can tell you there's not a 10th circuit that squarely addresses the issue. We cited a few that are relevant, but there's nothing that is certainly controlling or even unreported decisions by the 10th circuit that are on point. I did not conduct a circuit-wide analysis, so I can't speak to how the other circuits come down on this, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. I see that I'm down to 3 minutes. Does anyone have any further questions? Okay. Seeing none, I would ask that the court affirm the judgment and sentence below and would submit on that. Thank you.
Thank you. And I believe, Ms. Hartfield, you have 1 minute and 33.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think Judge Ebell made most of my arguments for me, so I don't want to say too much.
I was not attempting to make any arguments. I was attempting to ask questions to get answers. And one of the ways you get answers is to make a postulate and then see what the response is. But I'm at this point, I am genuinely not making an argument for anybody because I haven't decided and I haven't heard what my colleagues have decided.
I apologize for the mischaracterization. I think, Judge, you asked the questions I would have asked. The one thing I would point the court to is the district court's ruling, and that is at volume 3, page 30. The very short ruling says, after careful consideration of the evidence presented, the objection to paragraphs 25 and 26 is denied. So the defense lawyer did object to paragraphs 25 and 26, which contain all of the relevant issues that are in this brief, in this appeal. Then the court says,
let me clarify. The defendant did not ask for a finding on mens rea with respect to the intent challenge on intent to commit murder. Am I correct about that?
That's correct. There was no specific objection on that. There was just a general objection to those paragraphs. The court then goes on to say, the court finds by a preponderance of the evidence that the assault and battery with a deadly weapon that is referenced in those paragraphs, more specifically, the shooting described in paragraphs 11 to 15, was committed by the defendant. So the court itself found this to be an assault and battery with a deadly weapon and then applied the assault with intent to commit murder or the attempted murder guidelines. So the ruling itself is somewhat confusing, but it's very clear that the judge made no attempt to find the requisite intent that would have justified the attempted murder guideline.
Was there any requirement that the judge do so without a specific request?
There's no case law from this circuit on that. There is a case from another circuit. It was the Harris case where the court found that the district court plainly erred when it made insufficient findings of fact to support a conclusion regarding the mental state. I did not find any case law from this circuit stating that, but in the Sixth Circuit did find that to be plain error in the Harris case.
Thank you. My colleagues have anything else?
No.
All right, we will take this matter under advisement.